Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. What does it mean to be middle class? We hear this constantly, especially from politicians. According to today's guest, journalist Alyssa Court, the rewards that used to come with being middle class in the U.S. have all but evaporated. According to a poll from the Washington Post and the Miller Center, 65% of Americans worry about paying everyday bills. Middle class life is 30% more expensive than it was 20 years ago. And in some cases, the cost of daily life has doubled. The cost of a four-year degree at a public college is nearly twice as much as it was in 1996. Twice as much. The cost of healthcare has almost doubled in that time frame, and renting or buying a home has become substantially more expensive. Unions and employee rights continue to be decimated as pensions and minimal benefits fade. These are facts that set the stage for Alyssa Court's new book, Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. In the book, she lays out how the strain on middle-class families is systematic and institutional. And we have done so many shows about these issues. We've laid out so many solutions over the years. The question is, how can we push politicians to implement policies that benefit working people of all incomes and backgrounds, and not just the wealthy? Alyssa Court is a journalist, writer, and editor. She's the executive editor of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, a journalism nonprofit devoted to supporting reporting on inequality by a number of reporters who've themselves fallen on hard times. Alyssa Court co-founded its current incarnation with the journalist Barbara Ehrenreich. Alyssa is also author of four nonfiction books, including Branded and Monetized. She also writes the Outclassed column for The Guardian. And Alyssa Court joins us from New York. Hi, Alyssa. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be on the show. Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you. I have to say, these stories were just so depressing. I mean, story after story, adjunct professors on food stamp, teachers who drive Uber at night. I mean, on and on. But it's so important to continue to talk about this. And you come at this with a lot of experience. You discovered how expensive and destabilizing childcare is after having a child. You had a very difficult pregnancy. You know, after writing about these issues for so many years and working with reporters who deal with these issues, how did that personal experience really affect you?
Well, to be clear, I'm not, working poor or even as struggling as most of the characters, subjects of my book are. But what I saw was when I got pregnant, I was too sick to work, and my husband and I were both freelancers. And so, freelance journalists. And so we had to buy our own health care, we were going through our savings, and we didn't have that much security. And it kind of gave me a portal into what so many other people are experiencing, even more acutely. So that started me on this journey where I went around into my community in New York and my friends, and then out further about journalists around the country, and then people from lots of different professions around the country, talking to them about this tension and this anxiety.
Well, I ask that because for those of us who don't have kids, you know, it's easy to, I mean, we just don't know how expensive childcare is. I mean, I've never heard of these 24/7 childcare centers that are now popping up across the country. I mean, we've done shows about childcare, but when you have a child, things really change at that point.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the 24-hour daycare facilities or just unusual daycare, a study was done that 9% of all daycare now is in off hours, you know, later in the day after work or on weekends or overnight. So this 24-hour daycare I embedded myself in is one of a growing number, and it's not the only new development. I mean, another new development with daycare is just how expensive it can be, and it's just become at this point, you know, it's estimated in New York is something like 38% of people's salaries.
And then, according to a study written in 2013, the cost of delivery for both vaginal and cesarean births has nearly tripled since 1996. The average cost for a C-section in the U.S. is $16,000, that was in 2013, compared with about $12,000 for a vaginal birth. What explains the cost that has tripled since 1996?
I mean, it has a lot to do with our healthcare system. There's just no way around it. When I was comparing it to other countries, you know, the cost of birth was like $2,000, $3,000.
Wow.
It was a very, very different situation. And, you know, you can see there's a recent study since this book came out of people talking about why they didn't want to have children or they wanted to have only one child. And almost, you know, I think the top reason was the cost. So, you know, it starts with birth, it starts with pregnancy, and it goes from there.
And it's important to note that women in France, Britain, Chile, the Netherlands, and South Africa all pay less for vaginal deliveries in hospitals. Much of that is covered by insurance or the state. You write that before you had your daughter, you had reported in Iceland, and Iceland's daddy leave, 90% of its paternal population receives daddy leave. And, I mean, we can go over all of the other countries where people get paid time off, whereas here in the U.S., only 14% of American workers have paid family leave.
Yeah, and so in Iceland, I went and did actually, it was a little radio story, among other things, and I was talking to this woman who was a tour guide in a house, a historical house, and she was explaining she had three different children, fathers, and was, I think at that point she was single, but she was able to make it work. And I was just thinking, this is an impossibility. This in the U.S., this would never, her life would not look like this. She was smiling. I was like, wow.
Mm. Yeah, that one really stood out. You also report that in Quebec, Canada, state insurance provides a parent up to 75% of his or her salary and covers up to 15 or 18 continuous weeks for the mom, 3 to 5 weeks for the dad. In Denmark, moms get 4 weeks of paid pregnancy leave before their child is even born. And this is getting a lot of attention in the media. New Zealand's Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, took 6 weeks of parental leave, and just recently a paid parental leave plan for New Zealand went into effect, giving parents born from July 1st 22 weeks of paid leave, as well as a weekly stipend for the first year. The United States, at one point during Nixon's administration, almost passed laws that would provide more time off. But why is the U.S. so behind on this front?
Well, part of what I'm theorizing in the book is it's about our attitude towards care in general and towards motherhood, towards parenthood, towards our most vulnerable populations. You know, we don't think that this is the job of our country in any way to make sure that families are secure, you know. And I think it's very short-sighted. And Nixon, indeed, it was like 1971.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to pass a Child Care Act, and at the end he vetoed it. It got through Congress. You know, you realize every time people say to me things, oh, this is pie in the sky, I say, yeah, this almost happened 47 years ago. So it's not like a radical choice. This is something that was seen as commonplace 47 years ago.
And where do you think that pie in the sky comment comes from, when every other wealthy country in the world provides so much time off and in some cases helps families in the first year, especially if they're struggling? Why is it so pie in the sky here?
Again, I do think it's this ruthless individualism. It's not just the right with this kind of bootstrap mentality, right? Look, you have to do this yourself. People often sort of go ad hominem on this, like, I did it myself, you know. It's not just that, it's also, you know, kind of discourse around things like lean in, like if you're on a more Democrat side, you know, like you need to fight for your salary and, mm-hmm. you know, argue on your own behalf. And sometimes there's no arguing, you know, you just don't have a position of strength and you can't get the support you need of any kind. So, you know, this is when our government needs to start coming in. If it's not going to be federally, it has to be locally or corporate, too. I mean, we could have companies with better policies, you know.
Today we're speaking with Alyssa Court. She's a journalist, executive editor of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, and her new book is called Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. And she has so many statistics in her book about how difficult it is for people who are highly educated, who are considered to have pretty good jobs with decent salaries in some cases, of course not all cases, and they just can't get ahead. In many cases, they cannot afford childcare. They have to work for Uber or Lyft at night to supplement their incomes because they're so low. You also have just some information about how difficult it is for working women who are pregnant. You focus on a woman called Daniela, is it Nanau?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, she was a discrimination lawyer, as it turned out, and I kind of like the sort of irony of her situation because she, when she was pregnant, she experienced discrimination. She believed she experienced discrimination and had felt like she had to hide her pregnancy and had been discouraged in her profession from having a kid too early, being, you know, in her early 30s. Because even by other women. And so I sort of used her story as a way of talking about some of the pitfalls, which can include outright discrimination, the cases that the EEOC has seen of pregnancy discrimination cases have risen multiply in the last 10 years or so. But beyond that, even just the way that women feel like they have to hide their pregnancy. So I write about that, and these are people I knew, friends, who would go for interviews, and they'd be wearing big sweaters and giant jackets because they didn't want their prospective bosses to know that they were pregnant. They thought they wouldn't get the job.
You cite one study that shows moms are hired for annual salaries an average of $11,000 less than salaries offered to their equally qualified but child-free peers. Can you talk a little bit more about what else you found in terms of discrimination against either women who are pregnant or women who are moms?
Well, yeah, that, they call that in social science, they call it the motherhood penalty. And it's this lower pay for women who have kids. And then with each child you have, I think it's something like 7% per child, your salary goes down. So you're basically penalized in the workplace for having kids. You're imagined to be a burden. But the opposite is true. I also found, I found many of the subjects in my book told me anecdotally that they worked better after they had children. So part of what I'm trying to do in the book is make the case that for something I call the motherhood advantage, for the very opposite. They had more intense focus. They organized their time better. Some of them were better leaders, you know. They were used to leading toddlers around or whatever and, structuring their time. And so I think one of the things we need to start thinking about, too, and with this bias is it may be based on very little real evidence. You know, it could just be bias against motherhood itself.
Hmm. Well, and what's amazing about Daniela Nanau's story, an employment lawyer, she tried to push a lot of different thoughts about her pregnancy out of her mind, about what would happen when she told her boss. And when she did tell her boss she was pregnant, she said he ignored her and refused to talk to her for a week.
Yeah, I mean, these are these kind of commonplace small moments of contempt that go across my book. You can see these tensions. They're not always outright political nightmares, but they're just negative experiences.
Today we're joined by Alyssa Court. We're having some technical issues. Are you okay in the studio there, Alyssa, or do you need a minute to get settled?
I'm hearing echoes.
Okay, I thought something was wrong. So Alyssa's hearing echoes. Are you still hearing it?
Let me try. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to let her on the phone. It's too distracting to have her hear echoes the whole. Why don't we just have you on the phone for the rest of the hour?
Oh, right. That's great.
Is that better? Okay.
Yeah, that's great. I don't hear an echo now.
Okay, great. Today we're speaking with Alyssa Court about her new book, Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. And she interviews a wide range of people who are just really struggling to get by, struggling to afford childcare. A number of adjunct professors that she interviews are on food stamps, teachers she interviews, work for Uber and Lyft at night. And if this sounds very familiar to you, if you are dealing with these issues, We'd love to hear from you. I mean, a lot of people in the Bay Area are just struggling to get by. She also has a chapter in here about tech workers who make six figures in some cases, and they are struggling to get by. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. A number of highly educated people that Alyssa interviews on a regular basis would like to remain anonymous, and if you'd like to remain anonymous, that is fine. Let's talk about your chapter, Hyper-Educated and Poor. You spoke to a number of adjunct professors who are on food stamps. Tell us a little bit about Professor Breanne Bolin.
Yeah, so Bree Bolin was working at a arts college in Chicago. She had a graduate degree. She was working multiple kind of shifts, if you will, many classes she was teaching, but her salary was usually, you know, very low. I don't know, sometimes it varied, $24,000, $30,000 tops, and she was teaching a lot, and she had a disabled son, young son, so her life was incredibly squeezed, and she felt like she had done everything right. She had gone to graduate school, she had aspired to a life that was more solid in some ways than the lives of the people that she'd grown up with, and it hadn't worked out for her. And she was one of, I don't know, 10 or 15 of these adjuncts that I spoke to.
An adjunct professor, Bolin, earned $4,350 a class and never more than $24,000 a year. And at the time that you interviewed her, she had $55 in the bank and $3,000 in credit card debt. Is this common, adjunct professors earning about $4,000 a class and not making?
Absolutely. That could be high.
Wow.
There are people who may earn $1,700 a class. I talked to someone who was teaching six classes and also in many different colleges, so they're commuting and between these classes. That person had a PhD. He's teaching history. And, yeah. So there was some study done of a survey done of a number of adjuncts, and it found that 62% of them were making $20,000.
So what explains this? At a time when the cost of a four-year degree at a public college is twice as much as it was in 1996, why is it that adjunct professors are making so little money?
There's a lot of different reasons for it. I mean, some of it is the bloated administrative costs at colleges and universities where there's something like 10 times as many administrators as there used to be, and they're paid, you know, considerably more than even tenure-track professors, right? There's now many more adjuncts than there were professors who are tenure-track. Tenure-track means like a permanent professor who gets health insurance, and their position is either, you know, is either renewable or is a kind of a life position, right? But it used to be that there were many more tenure-track professors, and now there's many more adjuncts, so it has switched. Part of that is that there's a lot more contingent labor in general, right? There's more freelancers. There are people can, you know, and to be honest, colleges are either for-profit or they're quasi-businesses. So it's kind of a supply and demand issue. They can get away with it. That's the best understanding I have. There's sometimes more complicated stuff, too, involving whether especially public colleges are getting enough funding, but at the end of the day, it would seem that they should be able to pay these professors adequately, and that parents of kids sending their kids to college should know how many of the professors are being paid this.
You report that the number of people with graduate degrees receiving food assistance or other forms of federal aid nearly tripled between 2007 and 2010. Those with a PhD who received assistance rose from about 9,700 to a whopping 33,000. At least 28% of households that used food stamps in 2013 were headed by a person with at least some college education. And this proportion was just 8% in 1980, according to an analysis by University of Kentucky economists.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, to be fair, there's more people going to college, right? But at the same time, it doesn't really reflect, you know, why is this? If we're being told all the time education is going to lead us in the best direction, is it really working for these people? You know, are there the jobs that they're being promised out there, despite our supposedly, you know, revived economy? What I found when I was reporting is not entirely.
Do we know, like, say, for example, in the 80s, what did adjunct professors make back then?
Probably something that commensurate. I mean, I was an adjunct, and I write about this a little, and it's probably part of my fire in this particular chapter. It's personal, too, because I had worked at a lot of these colleges in the New York system, the CUNY system. And, yeah, it was something, it was, I forget what it was, but it was very low, but it was not like that much lower than, I mean, how low could it be?
Right.
You know?
Well, and the cost of living obviously was much cheaper back then because,
yeah,
as you also report, and this is another statistic that people in the Bay Area are probably shaking their heads, middle class life is now 30% more expensive than it was 20 years ago. And in some cases, the cost of daily life has doubled.
Yeah, and you saw, I mean, you guys must be talking all over this, but that report that is $117,000 a year earnings qualifies you as lower income, right, in the San Francisco area?
Right, exactly. This is like, yeah, $115,000 for a couple.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the number. Today we're speaking with journalist Alyssa Court about her new book, Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. And let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Nan in San Francisco. Hi, Nan. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, Rose. Thank you for taking my call. I enjoy your show, and I've never called in. Should I have my... Well, anyway.
Oh, I'm glad you called. Go ahead.
Thank you. So far, I've heard your guest. I haven't read her book, so I don't know if she goes into this. But she's hypothesized about why sort of we're in the situation we're in and sort of the value of being a parent, you know, and those contributions, you know, both at a job and to society you can make being in that position. And I'll just preface by saying that I'm currently a single mom in San Francisco with two kids, you know, trying to make it in a big city. And I think one of the things that hasn't been discussed so far is that I think, you know, we live in an oligarchy, which is not true of some other countries, their governments. And I know there have been many studies where people primed with a certain degree of money are less altruistic, actually. And I don't think it's just a question of convincing the government or establishment in power the value of these things. I think there's a sort of if you know what I'm saying, sort of an oligarchic foundation to the lack of support for this, that this establishment in power can't really be convinced of the value of this thing. We have to take a different tack in order to get the benefits that other societies have fought for and now sort of take for granted. Does that make question? That makes sense?
It makes perfect sense, Nan.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And lurking below all of this, I'll be direct about this, is income inequality and wage disparity. And, you know, compared to 40 years ago, American families in the bottom 80% are making $11,000 less a year, and those in the top 1% are making $750,000 more. Mm-hmm. So that is what is going on below all of this, and it sort of thrums through my book, and it's probably thrumming through a lot of people's lives right now. And it is. It's a setup. You know, I'd like to put it in my book, it's the, you know, you're betting against the house, but the house is always going to win.
Hmm. Wow. Well, thank you for calling in, Nan. We have a related email from Mira who says, I'm curious how much of this dynamic is intentionally imposed by elites. It seems obvious that healthcare, housing, and educational costs are way beyond any sort of pulling oneself up by the bootstraps, individualism. All anyone has to do is crunch the numbers to recognize the impossibility of overcoming these costs. Subject to these extreme financial forces, we're locked in place in our rent-controlled apartments, kept quiet in the workplace, and feeling defeated, hopeless, powerless, and depressed. Well, Mira, Alyssa spoke with a lot of people who said the same thing. They actually felt really bad about where they are, never expected to be in this position. And we'll get Alyssa to comment right after a break. We're joined today by Alyssa Court. She's a journalist who's out with a new book, Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the effects of prison reform and what else needs to happen. We've seen some success on that front, but there's so much more work to be done. We'll be talking about that. And then on Friday, it's our media roundtable. We'll be joined by longtime journalist Thomas Frank, who is out with a book, Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society, which in some cases is related to what we are talking about today with journalist Alyssa Court. She is executive editor of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, a journalism nonprofit devoted to supporting reporting on inequality by a number of reporters who have themselves fallen on hard times. And Alyssa's new book is Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. Alyssa, what about the email from Mira, who says that so many people are locked in their rent control apartments, really lucky if they still have one, especially here in San Francisco. At least that's what we're always told. You're lucky you have a rent control apartment, kept quiet in the workplace and feeling defeated, hopeless, powerless, and depressed.
Yeah, I mean, I was there. I mean, I got out of it, but I was there, and so many of my close friends are there. You know, I had a phrase I started using, rent controlled, because I felt that it almost would be in this amazing set of one-act plays, just all these people who are kind of haunted by the good luck of their apartments and forced to make all these bizarre compromises to live there, you know, to live with their families. It's absolutely true, and that's so many of the people I spoke to were in, had accommodated, you know, bent over, you know, leaned over, as one of them says, not leaned in, you know, to live in a way that made sense, and so they could still retain some kind of quality of life. You know, one of the subjects said something beautiful, was like, everyone in America thinks they're just a temporarily embarrassed millionaire. I am no exception. And I think that's the feeling. And one of the things I'm hoping to get out of this book, and I hope the readers will get, either from reading it or just listening to this, is that you're not alone, and, you know, you should shrug off that stigma around it, and we have to start organizing. I call the group of these people, the middle class, the shaken middle class, the unstable middle class, the middle precariat, meaning precarious, you know, vulnerable, but still middle class in education aspirations, and we need to unite with the working precariat, as we've been doing in, for the Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York. That gave me a lot of hope. I felt like this is a solidarity, intra-class kind of moment, and that's the best thing that can come out of us recognizing that we're precarious, that we then stop looking up at the 1% and start looking at the other people around us who are also precarious.
Well, and to the point that Mira made, a lot of people are, you know, going to bed afraid that they're going to have an eviction notice on their door the next day. You spoke with a number of people who just feel really awful about the situation that they're in. Can you also talk about that, the emotional aspects of all of this, what it does to our overall well-being?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I saw, I mean, I felt it when I was pregnant and then before I started working at this nonprofit. I mean, and I see it with the people I know, and I see it with the people I report on. It's this anxiety. It's a sense of not really having a script for the way their life is going to go. And so it's both psychological and existential as well as financial. And when I say squeezed, I mean a squeeze that's financial, but it has these other kind of emotional elements. You're kind of compressed. You don't know what your future will hold. You can't even think about what your old age is going to be like, and that sort of changes your life. Some of the people I've spoken to on the road since this book came out, they'll say things like, you know, my parents don't understand me because their lives were so different. You know, they're people in their 30s and 40s with children. Their parents' lives followed a more predictable trajectory, and some of this is just that. Now, for the people I spoke to and interviewed, and the people I'm talking to now, their lives are unpredictable. They don't know where they're going, and there's a lot of confusion in that.
You also write about how some of the educated people you interviewed felt a certain guilt about pursuing their dreams, and they had shame about ending up in financial dire straits. And you quote Mia Tokumitsu, who's the author of Do What You Love and Other Lies About Success and Happiness. And she writes that doing what you love in America has been co-opted by corporations to better exploit their workers.
Yeah, I mean, I think doing what you love, you know, it's the motto of WeWork, or one of the mottos of WeWork, the co-working company. Mm-hmm. And it's something that you hear a lot, right? It's like sort of like what color is your parachute was in the 70s. It's do what you love now or follow your dreams. But one of the things that can happen when you follow your dreams or do what you love in this particular moment in history can be that you're a little, you wind up kind of lost. And and you feel as if you bought into a storyline that doesn't exist anymore.
Let's talk about your chapter, Outclassed, Life at the Bottom of the Top. And you focus on Sean Tanner, someone who, on the face of it, wasn't someone who needed saving. By most measures, Tanner at 38 made a fine living in the very low six figures. He had a $3,000 monthly mortgage, which was less than half of his monthly income. In 2016, he worked three jobs to pay for his high health insurance. He was a meteorologist for Weather Underground, a weather site. He's an independent contractor and an instructor at San Jose State University. In other words, you write, he was not as under siege financially or as pressed for time as other people. For example, someone who runs the 24-hour daycare center or the frantic parents of the children who attended it. Nevertheless, Sean Tanner felt tense.
Yeah, I mean, he was living in the shadow of the tech industry, as many of your listeners are. And, you know, he felt it was bad, had been bad for him and his friends, too, because most of them didn't have, as he put it, ridiculous tech jobs. But the very cost of living had created these very alienating comparisons. And I wanted to include him and some of these people at the top of the scale of middle class, which is sort of $42,000 to $125,000, say, a year, because in places like the Bay Area, indeed, someone making $115,000 is not what they would be in most other places in this country. And so they're caught because they're sort of seen as affluent whiners, perhaps, but, you know, if you live in San Francisco, you know otherwise, right?
No, exactly. And I mean, if you're making 115 and you have a rent-controlled apartment, you are doing pretty well. But if you're making 115 and you're paying $3,000 a month, that's extremely difficult. And you have a family. That adds a whole, you know, that's even more struggle.
Yeah, and I talked to other people in the Bay Area who are trying to afford daycare. And again, these could sound like Bobo worries and whatnot, but they were, you know, it was hard for them to even find a place in an affordable daycare. Mm-hmm. So but it's so competitive now to get your kid into a daycare. They're really hard to access. The positions that are, like, you know, good warm daycares that are not incredibly expensive. So that there's a ton of different kinds of pressures for someone like Sean and some of the other people I spoke to in the Bay Area.
We've done a lot of shows about how expensive daycare is, and we've also talked about how it's subsidized in other countries. I mean, this is one clear solution. You know, where are the pro-family Republicans on this issue? Why is it so difficult to pass legislation that would subsidize childcare in this country?
But again, I have to go back to this ruthless individualism, as well as some of the contempt I think we have for care and care work, which is related but not exactly the same. I started to read a lot of the kind of social science and philosophy around care work, and I kept seeing references to something called prisoner of love, which means that the daycare worker, the nanny or the babysitter, is supposedly more willing to accept low wages for their work because they love their charges. They love the kids they're caring for, and I don't know, maybe they love the elders they're caring for. And so the fact it's such a heart job, as it were, like a job filled with intimate emotion, is manipulated to underpay them. So another strange thing, right, is that the care workers, I write about them at length, are underpaid. Mm-hmm. But then the parents, who are middle class, are struggling to pay them. and they're like a nesting dolls. I talk about them as like nesting dolls in those Russian dolls that are one within the other, and they're sort of all struggling in different ways.
Do you think this has to come at the city level? Because you write about universal pre-K, and you first encountered the program in New York. And to understand universal pre-K better and discuss ideas for nationalizing it, you interviewed Richard Burry, who's coordinator of the city's universal pre-K program under Mayor Bill de Blasio. How did they do it there?
Well, what I loved when I talked to him about the process, because I don't really know that much about how, I mean, everyone in New York just watched this happen. It seemed like it was happening overnight. It was an astonishing pace, and we're like, how did this happen? And he was explaining that part of it was they were not picky about their sites. So they were putting universal pre-Ks in synagogues and churches, you know, in kind of these small, strange spaces, right, that you wouldn't think, oh, this is a great place for pre-K, or in religious buildings that you think, oh, there's a church and state problem. But that, it really worked, because it was they were thus able to get it happening on a large scale, and it's helped tens of thousands of people.
I mean, the numbers are amazing, but not surprising. The rollout of universal pre-K was fast, ramping up from 20,000 pre-K seats in January 2014 to 51,000 to 68,000 by September 2015. I mean, it's not surprising. It's almost like when we hear about tuition-free community college, and the number of people signing up just completely blows away expectations. And this is costing $1.5 billion over 5 years in New York.
Right. And you think of some real estate development, and you're like, $1.5 billion might sound like a lot, but in certain contexts, not so much, you know? Also, the fact that a lot of the parents, he was telling me, Richard Burry, that they were so thankful not only that their kids were getting an early education, but they would be somewhere safe, you know, during the day, and they wouldn't have to depend on informal daycare networks, right? So the other option wasn't going to be, oh, they're in some great daycare. It might be that they would have to depend on a neighbor, et cetera, you know?
Right.
So it really changed the texture of daily life as well as their financial stability. And I started to think, like, what if this was all around the country? Mm. How different would so many people's lives be?
Alyssa Court is a journalist who's out with a new book called Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. And she points out that 65% of Americans worry about paying their bills. She interviews caregivers, teachers, adjunct professors, lawyers, tech workers. And all of these people have a hard time making ends meet. Adjunct professors are on food stamps. Teachers drive for Uber and Lyft at night. And if this speaks to you, we'd love to hear from you. Share your experience. You can remain anonymous. I feel like what's difficult about this is we always talk about solutions, and we know what really needs to be done. Look what happened in New York. Paid family leave is a major solution. Living wage, raising teacher salaries, raising adjunct professor salaries. The question is, how do we get there? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We have a comment on our Facebook page from Veronica, and you write about this, Alyssa. She says, gender bias and deep disdain for women's work is also a factor.
It's a huge factor. I write about that at great length. And the history of some of the movements that have pushed back against it. It was alternatively called wages for housework and wages against housework. But there were movements in the 70s that wanted to politicize, you know, what's now called emotional labor or unpaid labor, you know, women cleaning in the home, caring for the kids, caring for their parents. And one of the things that I think needs to happen, and more people are talking about this, is things like universal basic income to offset the cost of taking care of a child or a parent, especially if the child is ill or has any kind of special needs. It's astronomical. So what if we could give families a stipend for this kind of care? And it's not just the child care credit that's $1,000 or $2,000, but something, you know, workable, $20,000, $18,000, you know?
We've done shows about universal basic income, and you wrote about what happened in 2017 in Ontario, Canada, which began implementing a three-year pilot basic income guarantee program. In three sites in the province, Ontario is offering individuals a set amount of money per month, up to $24,000 a year per person. It's expected to cost $50 million annually and is open to any single person earning less than about $34,000 and couples earning less than $48,000.
Yeah, so that's an example. It's also happening in Stockton, closer to you. And people are talking about that more and more. And again, it's easy to write that off as an absurdity, but why? I mean, one of the things I kept thinking about when I was looking at these solutions that people, you know, perhaps to the right of me might find absurd or outlandishly improbable is look at Me Too. Look at gay marriage. Sure, there's been long movements behind both of these kind of awakenings culturally and changes in law and so forth, but like something really big has been happening. Norms are changing. Why can't the norms change around some of these issues, things like UBI or subsidized daycare or maternity leave?
Well, let's talk about Uber dads. I mean, I've heard of people who drive, well, I've met people and interviewed people who drive for Uber and Lyft to subsidize their incomes, but I didn't realize the extent to which Uber actually tries to reach out to teachers. But first, let's talk about an example. Matt Berry taught history at Live Oak High School, a public school in the suburb of San Jose. At 32, he was in his ninth year on the job. 5 days a week, he stands in front of 35 11th and 12th graders instructing in AP American History. But he had a secret life that's becoming increasingly common among school teachers. He had been spending his afternoon school hours and weekdays as an Uber driver to earn enough extra money to prepare financially for the birth of his first child. And Barry and his wife, Nicole, taught. They each earn $69,000, which should be and is solidly within the middle class, but not if you live in Silicon Valley.
Right, and he was one of 10 teachers that I spoke to who were Uber and Lyft drivers on the side, whose family lives were very challenging economically and also in terms of time because of the cost of living in the Bay Area and in California. So what wound up happening is they wound up teaching all day and then driving at night or on weekends. They're grading at stop signs, at lights. One of them said something along the lines of, I should be at home doing my curriculum, but here I am, you know, behind the wheel. And Uber, in fact, had a whole campaign, I found out. It was called something like Uber Driving, Teachers Driving Our Future, where they tried to recruit teachers and nurses, too. They tried to recruit middle-class professions that, especially in the case of teachers, were underpaid, and they knew that they could get them to do this driving on the side. And then they were sort of using the respectability of the teacher, the idea of the teacher. Well, the teachers themselves, that respectability meant that they were in, say, North Dakota making $32,000. Mm-hmm. You know, it was more valuable in the gig economy, in the open market, than it was in its actual thing. You know, actually teaching was worth too little, but for Uber it was worth a lot.
And what's been amazing about the teacher strike is I feel like for the first time in a long time, teachers are actually telling their own stories. Whereas I think it was, 5 or 7 years ago, there was so much criticism of teachers. And you heard from the, quote, education reformers, but not really the teachers. And so in the media in the last year, we've heard from people like the woman you wrote about, Rebecca Maloney, who's an elementary school teacher in Mandan, North Dakota, a single mom with three kids. And she had to launch a GoFundMe $1,000 campaign to pay for her career development class that she wanted to take at a local university to become a better teacher.
Yeah, and I actually wrote a story recently about GoFundMe in Montana, where there's a whole kind of world of GoFundMe to fund school lunches that teachers are running. They're running these GoFundMe because the kids who can't afford the school lunches are being lunch shamed. They're being humiliated for not being able to pay for their lunch. Their parents are not able to pay. And so they have to raise money through this crowdfunding site in order to pay for lunches.
We should point out that the United States is the richest and also the most unequal country in the world. It has the largest wealth inequality gap of the 200 countries in the Global Wealth Report of 2015. And I wanted to just mention, going back to Uber, David Plouffe, who was Barack Obama's campaign manager, was the senior VP of Uber until 2015. And he wrote a story about Uber's PR strategy. And he wrote, "The Uber platform serves as, quote, the pay raise the drivers have not received in their other jobs."
Yeah.
I had to read that one twice.
Yeah. I mean, later in the book, I actually talked to someone who's been working to make robots to replace kind of janitorial staff and pharmacists in hospitals. Mm. And he said, yeah, we use these robots to replace FTEs. And I thought, oh, that's another robot. I was like, oh, really? What are FTEs? He's like, full-time employees.
Wow.
Yeah.
When you wrote about robots, Alyssa, this is another debate that people are having. Some say that this is coming and it's going to come quickly. And others say you don't have that much to worry about. Robots will never be able to replace the majority of workers. What did you find?
I mean, I was just looking at statistically, you know, there's a lot of employees are going to be replaced by robots, especially in fields, yes, in lower income and lower educated fields, like it's already happening, movie ushers, retail, right?
Mm-hmm.
Fast food. But I also found it be, you know, robots are replacing and algorithms are replacing nurses, lawyers, and journalists. There's a company called Automated Insights, which is, I joke, is like a great oxymoron. No, Insight is automated. And they are now supplying content for journalistic outfits.
How does a robot provide content?
Well, yeah, it's sort of it's some kind of algorithm that's at work, and they're I think I have to double check which sites they're, but they're major sites. It's like Trunk, which was the Tribune site.
Mm-hmm.
They generate stories for Forbes. They publish stories on companies' quarterly earnings, like Apple Top Street forecasts, and they're written without a byline because they're written by a computerized system.
Oh.
Yeah.
We have a Twitter comment from JC who says, in the 80s, it was easy to get hired in a restaurant or a retail job with full-time hours. Today, it's impossible. Either you get part-time hours and no benefits, or are made manager, paid salary, and work 60 hours plus. And you write about this. So many people you interviewed, and I think this number is right, they're not getting 30 hours, because at that point, then they have to get benefits?
Yeah, so they were working 29 hours or less. And they were also working, and I write about this in the book, strange hours. So they were, because of algorithms, again, this is another robot problem. We're changing whether we're instructing the companies these workers worked for, oh, you should have them working at 3 in the afternoon to 8 at night, which, of course, would then wreak havoc on their family lives.
Well, Alyssa, we have just a couple minutes left. And after, you know, you have written about these issues for many, many years. And after writing this book, I mean, where do we go from here? Because while people are struggling to make ends meet, they're also dealing with massive student debt. These numbers are just astounding. At least 17.5% of the $1.3 trillion of outstanding student loan debt belongs to those 50 years old as of 2015. I mean, you interviewed people who are lawyers who have really good jobs. In some cases, two lawyers in one family, but they have $400,000 in student debt. So a lot of people are just struggling to get out of this hole, let alone pay their everyday bills.
Yeah, and I think we need to start talking about different relationships to debt, especially student debt. Debt forgiveness, and I write about projects like the Debt Collective and Rolling Jubilee that have done that, that have organized to pay off students' debt. We also have to talk about better regulation on for-profit colleges. A number of the people I wrote about had attended colleges that some of which, like Trump University, right, have been sued, are now defunct. They're for-profit. Their degrees are not particularly meaningful. or sometimes they're negatives, and then they wind up with $59,000 in debt. So we need more oversight on these for-profit colleges. And then we also need to start thinking, should we get that second graduate degree when we're, or first graduate degree when we're in our 40s? And those are more personal decisions, but I, you know, as far as I could see, there, a lot of the times people wound up in worse positions than they had been before.
We don't have time to take Michael's call, but he wants to know, to what extent can we question the monetary system itself?
Oh, I love that. I guess I want to know a little more what he means by that. Does he mean actual, you know, the coin of the realm, or does he mean how it's organized?
Well, we have 1 minute. Let's take Michael. Michael, what do you mean by that exactly? Just briefly.
So an example is Flint, Michigan. I heard this, you know, horrible story, and it's a lot about children suffering. And then you get at the end of the radio piece, and it's all about money, you know, and it's just hard for me to believe that money is the cause of these things, you know.
Well, money, Alyssa, what about that? I mean, when you look at CEO pay, let's take Disney, for example. Walt Disney's CEO, Robert Iger, made $36 million a year last year. I mean, yes, $36 million a year. So $3 million a month, when his most Disney workers don't even make 15 bucks an hour.
Yeah, they don't. They don't. We actually did a piece on that. But since 1997, the top 1% income has grown 20 times faster than the other 90%. So when you're looking at that kind of, you know, curve, it does start to seem like an evil plot.
Well, right. I mean, just a couple more. Comcast CEO Brian Roberts makes $32 million a year. The Priceline Group, Glenn Fogel, makes $27 million a year. Chevron, $24 million. Netflix, $24 million. I mean, it's just, and those are at the sort of the bottom of the list.
Yep.
Alyssa, a couple people online also said another solution here is to end Citizens United. Money and politics is a main reason why we got here. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree, and that was part of why I was saying we need to organize around candidates like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others that are coming up now locally that have campaign finance first and top of mind, you know, who recognize there's a relationship between the money in politics and the lack of money in ordinary life.
And next week, we are doing a show about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's victory and whether or not it is possible to reform the Democratic Party from within. So I think that's a really important question that needs to be asked. Alyssa, thank you so much for all of your work, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, it was so fun and interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Alyssa Court is executive editor of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Find a link to their work at our website. They do very important work. A lot of the articles are written by journalists who are struggling to make ends meet. And Alyssa's new book is called Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about incarceration. 2.2 million people in the U.S. are incarcerated. That number is at a two-decade low, according to a recent Bureau of Justice Statistics report. We're going to talk about criminal justice reform. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.